Can everyone hear me? Okay. I will try to speak as simple and clear as possible. I want to talk about the principles of Zen practice, but I want to go through Zen practice as I talk about it. So it's not just a lecture, but a demonstration as well. Please feel free to enter into and go along as much as you would like. I want to begin with two words in English: calm and clear. If you can realize the Zen meaning of these two words, you've got it. That will do. Calm, completely at rest, still, do you say? Still? Calm, at rest, and clear, clear, clarity, seeing through. Calm and clear. As I go through, I think you will see what I'm talking about. When you practice Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, from where do we start? From where do we practice? To put it another way, to where? Where are we going? Where is our goal? For what end? To put it another way, for whom are we sitting? Are we practicing? Who is sitting? And for whom? You understand already to some extent. Calm and clear. Obviously something about doing Zazen, you're supposed to get calm and clear, I guess. And yet, as a matter of fact, we're often not calm. And we're not clear. Right? Perhaps that's why many of you are... Perhaps that's why many of us are here tonight. Because maybe we want to be calm and clear, but we're not. So as we go through, keep in mind, where are we actually practicing from? Where are we trying to get to? Put it another way, who is practicing? Who is sitting there? For whom? For yourself? For another? Let me read a quote and see if you can see what I'm talking about. This is from a classic book on Buddhism, not Zen, by Walpola Rahula, a famous Theravada monk. The book is called What the Buddha Taught, one of the most famous books in English on Buddhism. Quote, "It is the source of all troubles in the world, from personal conflicts to wars between nations. In short, to this false view can be traced all the evil in the world." That's the end of the quote. My question is, what is he talking about? It. What is it? I'll read it again. It is the source of all the troubles in the world, from personal conflicts to wars between nations. In short, to this false view can be traced all the evil in the world. Pretty heavy. What is he talking about? What is it? It sounds pretty big, doesn't it? Well, of course, he's talking about what in Buddhism is called the ego. It, this false sense of self, is the source of all the troubles in the world. This is pretty dramatic, especially for a Theravada Buddhist monk. He's saying it's all right here. Again, it, the ego, is the source of all the troubles in the world, from personal conflicts between people to wars between nations. In short, to this false view — he calls it a false view, though. This is a technical Buddhist term. In other words, this ego is not real. It's an illusion. It is technically a false view, an unreal and inaccurate view. There is no such thing. And yet we all know that it can be a very painful, very powerful delusion, a very dangerous delusion. Again, it's a false view, technically speaking, in Buddhism. But it's a very powerful and a very dangerous one. Returning to the quote, to this false view can be traced all the evil in the world. He uses the word evil. Maybe some of you ex-Christians might be uncomfortable with that. I think he uses that term because he's trying to say, for example, natural disasters are not what he's talking about. An earthquake that kills 1,000 people is a terrible disaster, but that's not evil. That's part of nature. Of course, it's not really that simple, because as we start to understand the role of the ego in the environment and the world, right, even natural disasters can be, to some extent, brought on by the abuse of the ego, natural environmental problems. But anyway, two points I think are clear. One is, this is it. This is it. This is the problem. And this isn't even Zen, this is basic Buddhism. Pretty clear, this is the problem. The other point is, it's an illusion. It's a false view. It's an illusion. But a very powerful, very tenacious one. So what do we do about it? What do we do about it? You might look at it simply, how do we get clear of, how do we get away from the unclarity, the lack of calmness? There are many, many, many different kinds of Buddhist meditation. Let's look, not just look, but actually try some of them so you can see what they're trying to do. Let's take two very concrete problems. Let's say you're trying to sit. You're trying to sit, but something keeps coming up. Maybe you're angry about something, somebody at work or at school or child or parent or whatever, you had a big fight and you are really angry. Maybe you even feel hatred towards that person, that group. And you're trying to be calm, but it's impossible because this thing keeps coming up. It's more real than your attempt at zazen. So what do you do? Well, one very simple method is what I call fight fire with fire. Or you can say fight fire with water. In other words, you bring up one thought, relatively speaking, a good thought, to get rid of a relatively speaking bad thought. For example, in Buddhism, they have what's called metta practice. Metta is something like loving kindness. So when you feel anger, hatred, revenge, and it's maybe so strong that you can't even do zazen, what you can do is take that thing, that person, that group, whatever, which you feel so much hatred for, and just try to bring up a feeling of love, of loving kindness toward that thing, and almost try to melt away that feeling. And I don't have time, unfortunately, to go into detail, but the Buddhist sutras and meditation manuals go into great detail about how to do this. So you see what they're suggesting you do. You take, in a sense, a particular attitude towards something. Hatred and anger. You actually try to feel the opposite. You try to promote, as best you can, a feeling of loving kindness toward that person or that group that you hate. It may not be easy at first, it may take some time, but over time you can actually overcome that feeling of hatred. You can actually feel that thing or that person which you hated becoming calm and becoming clear. It's not that you're denying it or you're hiding it. Those feelings are actually becoming transformed. This is a very specific kind of meditation for a specific thing. You can say rather than meditating, it's an attempt to overcome a particular problem that is preventing you from meditating. Right? Hopefully over time that feeling of hatred and anger dissolves, dissipates. Then, in a sense, you can get down to the work. Although that in itself is a very positive thing to do. Right? Rather than being eaten up by anger or by hatred. Right? To be able to dissolve that. Fighting fire with fire, or fire with water, trying to douse that flame so that it's calm. Okay? Let's take a look at one other very specific kind of Buddhist meditation. Instead of anger or hatred, let's say you feel a real strong sexual desire. You're trying to sit zazen and get enlightened, and meanwhile all this pornographic stuff keeps coming up, or whatever. Or maybe, you know, you have the hots for your friend's wife or friend's husband or whatever it is, and you're supposed to be doing zazen, but that's just not happening. You're just overcome with these images or sexual desires. So what do you do about that? What do you do about that? There are very specific Buddhist meditation techniques for that too. Obviously the monks 2,500 years ago had the same problem. The nuns did too. So they have developed, and they're in the sutras, specific meditation techniques. One is you simply take the object of your desire and very clearly look at it, see it. So you see this beautiful form. Now see it when it's 60 years old, as best as you can. There are two basic ways to do this. One is actually to go to a cemetery, you see where we're going, right? And actually see the decomposed bodies. The other is you simply do it in your imagination as best you can. Either way will do, I assure you. Well, let's do the imagination, that's easier. But in India, of course, even today, you can fairly easily see dead bodies in different stages of, you know, decomposure. But even if you just imagine it, you take that beautiful figure that you're so obsessed with, how will it look, actually? How will it actually look, as best as you can imagine, when it's 60, 80? Got a nice, clear image. Do it, really. See it. 80. All those wrinkles and the sags that used to be so tight. 100. It is dead now, huh? Now starting to decompose. Maybe there's bugs. Pick, you know, and they go through in great detail. The fluids coming out of the body and all. Well, you see what we're trying to do here, right? You're trying to fight fire with fire or fight fire with water. After a while, that beautiful image is not so beautiful anymore. It's not that you're refusing to see it, but you're not just seeing it in one way. You're seeing it in a different way, in a new way. It's a very specific meditative technique for a specific problem, a specific obsession. But what is all Buddhist meditation aiming at? Where are we trying to get to? Are we just trying to get rid of all desire? Or have no more feelings, no anger, no hatred, no desire, no anything? What's the real end? What's the point? In traditional, I'm not talking about Zen yet, in traditional Buddhist terminology, they talk about three marks of existence. Everything. You, your friend, your enemy. Everything. Everything has these three marks. And that is what you are trying to clearly see in that meditation. In other words, when you're trying to transform that hatred into love, this is a good thing, but that's not the point. That's not the final goal of the meditation. The final goal of the meditation is to see clearly, actually see these three marks. It's the same thing with sexual desire. You're not just trying to see this beautiful woman or man as an old hag or as a dead person. That's not the goal. The real goal is to see those same three marks. Those three marks are impermanent, that everything is impermanent, whether it be a feeling of hatred or a feeling of sexual desire or beauty. It is impermanent. It is, the second one is tricky, it's dukkha in Pali or Sanskrit. It also happens to be the first noble truth of Buddhism. And it's often translated as all things are suffering, which is a very inadequate translation. I render it as dis-ease. All things are impermanent, not permanent. They do not exist forever unchanged. Everything is impermanent. The second one, everything is dis-ease. or unstable. It's inherently not stable. It's, of course, very much connected with being impermanent. It is unstable. Dis-ease. We cannot come fully to rest in anything because it has that mark. Impermanent, shall we say unstable? Is that good for Dutch English? Unstable. Dis-ease, not disease, but dis-ease. And the third mark is that there is no ego. It is without ego. All things are without ego. Look, the quote I miss here. This is the fundamental principle behind Buddhist meditation, every kind of Buddhist meditation. Whatever Buddhist kind of meditation you're doing, if it's genuinely Buddhist, in a sense, you're trying to actually see the reality that is there, which they describe as impermanent, unstable, and without a substantial ego, without an unchanging ego. You see how connected these three marks are. In a sense, they're saying the same thing from a different angle. But still, three is a little complicated, so let's make it even simpler. In a couple of the basic Buddhist sutras, Gautama Shakyamuni was asked, can you explain the essence of your teaching in one sentence? And Gautama Shakyamuni said, yes, I can. And you know how the sutras are all very, oh, how can you do it? I can do it this way. And after about two pages later, you actually finally get this one sentence. But, you know, they're doing it partly to memorize it so they didn't write it down. But anyway, the point is, what is the one sentence that describes the essence of the Buddha's teaching, according to these sutras? It says, nothing whatever should be clung to, grasped. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to. Later they added on, as I or as mine, but actually the statement itself in Pali, nothing whatever to cling to grasp. Right? And you see, it's saying the same thing. Everything is impermanent. Everything is unstable or dis-ease. We cannot come fully to rest with that. And everything is without substantial ego, without ego. Nothing whatever should be clung to. Even simpler, there is nothing to cling to grasp, to hold on to. There is nothing whatever to cling to. That may sound very negative, very nihilistic maybe. And Buddhism, early Buddhism especially, has often sounds that way. But of course, the end where they're going with that is very, very positive. Very, very positive. It's dealing with liberation. Our total liberation, even from ourselves. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to. More simply, there's nothing whatever to cling to hold on to grasp. That's the basis of Buddhist meditation as well. That's not just the basis of Buddhist philosophy. It's the basis of Buddhist meditation. Now let's look at Zen meditation. What is Zen meditation? What is Zazen then? Maybe you already can see, well, yeah, I can see that in the background, but that's not quite Zazen, is it? In a sense, it is quite different. The approach is different. What is Zazen about? Of course, it's a kind of Buddhist meditation, but it's you might say, distinctly Zen meditation.
What is that?
I've tried to find the most essential, just like I did with Buddhism. What is the most essential way of describing Zen practice? Not simply describing it, but that actually demonstrates it, that actually shows it in action. I would put it this way. Instead of fighting fire with fire or fighting fire with water, I explain those very specific kind of techniques for specific feelings that you may have. You can say that Zazen has to do with your awareness itself without any kind of a gap, without any kind of a gap. How would you describe this? Well, this is the classic Zen expression of what Zazen is. It's very difficult to translate. I spent a long time, I even wrote some emails to some of the people here asking their thoughts on how to put this in simple English. It's only four Chinese characters. So it sounds very simple, but it's an image, it's a metaphor, it's Chinese, and a couple other things. So I got it down to two translations, so you can pick the one you like. One is literally, turn back the light and discover the source. The light, of course, refers to the light of awareness, right? It's a metaphor, the light of your awareness. Turn back the light and discover its source. Another way to say it is cast, shine. Cast the light back on the source. Reflect awareness back on the source. Rinzai, the father of Rinzai Zen, uses that statement. It's in the record of Rinzai. Dogen, as the father of Soto Zen, often uses it. It's in the first Zen meditation manual from a couple centuries before Dogen. And it's constantly quoted. The problem is there are so many different translations for those four characters. There's a book called Tracing Back the Radiance. Guess what? It's the same thing. It's the same four characters. It's a book about Korean Zen. A very good book. But he translates it as Tracing Back the Radiance. I don't like that because it sounds like, you know, going step by step, and it's not talking about that. Let's look more carefully at what that really means, because it's all right there. The beginning, the middle, and the end of Zen practice are right in those four characters. Turn back the light of awareness. What does that mean? What we are so used to doing is going forward with our awareness. Either whether we imagine something, whether we see something, whether we think something, whether we desire something, whether we hate something, or whether we love something. Our awareness is going toward that thing or going away from it. It's the same thing. It's a movement. We're going out into that thing, if we desire it, or trying to get away from it, perhaps if we hate it, if we detest it. So the first two characters literally talk about turning back the light of awareness. In other words, looking at the source of that. Where does this all come from? Right now we have pillows, we have bricks, we have walls, we have people. We have hot, we have cold, we have love, we have hate. Where does that all come from? And of course in Buddhism it's clear. We're not talking about some metaphysical reality, some transcendent reality, or some God. We're talking about the source of our present awareness. Okay? Each and every one of us is right now listening. Each and every one of us is that source of awareness. But we don't see it because we're so busy turning it into a pillow or a little bit of discomfort or very comfortable or isn't that stupid, isn't that smart, I like this, I hate that, whatever it is. And so we go on. Zazen is simply taking that back to the source, right here. The source. Where is your awareness coming from right now? And you see, when can you work on this? At any moment, it's there. You don't have to go back to the last moment. Every moment, you're aware. And every moment, you're going out. Every moment is that opportunity to, again, it's a metaphor, turn back. Well, even to say that, you know what the problem here is? We think turning back means going inside, right? No, because that's also outside. In other words, if we look at it in terms of the senses, obviously we're not going out into the particular things we see or the particular sounds. But the mind, which includes the feelings, the emotions, and the desires, is just another sense in Buddhism. It's very interesting. So it's not saying stop using your external senses, ears, eyes, nose, mouth, tongue, and taste, and go into a world of thoughts and ideas and imagination. No, that's just as much outside as the rest of it is. According to Buddhism, it's clear. Okay? So when we say turn back, it's often misunderstood to mean go inside yourself. That is not what it is about. Is that clear? That's just as far from it as going out into a vision. Thoughts are no closer to it than something you see, or something you hear, or something you smell. Okay? Is it clear? Turn back means to the source, not simply internally. To the source out of which internal and external comes. Okay, it has nothing to do with being inside. It is the source of everything inside and outside. It is what allows there to be an inside and an outside. That source. So turn back. It's tricky. But that's all Zazen is. Zazen is simply that. It's that subtle of a movement. Even to say a movement is also a metaphor, of course. On the source of this present awareness. So you see why it can be done at any moment. You don't need anything to do it. It's already there. Just trace it back to the source. And you can do that with each and every moment. You never have to go back or forward. Each moment can be traced back to that source, because each moment comes from that source. Sometimes this quote is given with two other characters. If anybody knows Japanese, it's Eko Hensho, and then sometimes they say Eko Hensho no Taiho. And Taiho means something like step back. You know, Chinese are great with these kinds of concrete images. So it's almost as if you're walking and you realize your mistake, and so you take one step back and then turn the light and reflect on the source. Right? But what does that really mean, to step back? What it means is put an end to all of the activities of your ordinary consciousness. Without that, in a sense, Zazen is impossible. If you simply sit there and then you follow this thought, and then you follow this thought, and then you follow this sound, you come back, and then you follow this sound, and then you follow this little pain in your leg, and then you follow this pleasant feeling. You see? In a sense, Zazen begins by putting a stop to that. But it's not an act of will. An act of will is also continuing along that false movement. Putting a stop is simply entering the source. Really putting a stop doesn't mean, you know, closing your eyes and your ears and stopping all consciousness. It means putting a stop to following that consciousness, that awareness, and turning it into something. A sound, a sight, a smell, a thought, an image, an emotion. It's all the same. Tracing back that to the source right here. So this stop, I translate it as stop. I think that's simpler rather than step back, because that can be misinterpreted. Put a stop to all activity of ordinary consciousness. Stop going out into the world. Stop creating things and see what is there. What is there right here and right now? What is there right here and right now before you have created anything with it? What is there right here and right now before a thought has arisen, before you have created, turned it into anything? You see how simple Zazen is? And then being able to continue that until that falls away. That's one simple way of describing the actual process, so to speak, of Zazen. You see how, in a way, it's a little bit different than more traditional Buddhist meditations, which tend to have a particular object in the beginning, which they're working on. Turning that anger and hatred into love by, in a sense, dissolving it. Or turning that troubling sexual desire into clearly seeing through the impermanence of that thing that, of course, when you're desirous of it, you don't think of it as impermanent, do you? But you want it to stay just like that, right? Don't go change it. Just, no, don't. You can't change. It has to stay. And we all know the hell that comes out of that, right? Calm and clear. In a sense, that's all I'm talking about. If you can really clearly see through, and that has to mean seeing the source of it all at each and every moment, then of course that means after you get up from Zazen, being able to see that source as you do something, as you act, as you make a decision, as you think. It's not just, that's useless. That's less than useless. Zazen has to be carried out in the activities of the real world. Zazen has to be carried out in the activities of the real world. What often happens is we do Zazen for a while, get a little bit of a rush or whatever, and then we see it dissipate, lessen, as we go out into the world. Well, is that real Zazen? Just once, if you can
illuminate.
That's another good way of putting it. To shine back the imagery, those four characters. Illuminate, right? Light up. Illuminate the source. Illuminate the source of awareness. Illuminate the source of awareness. And the strange thing is, once that happens, that such a subtle little movement, once that happens, it's no longer you shining the light on the source. This is a problem with language. As a process, yes, it's a discipline, and you need patience. And you need to be able to, in a sense, learn how to do that. Learn how to let go of your tendency to go out into the world. And if you read the meditation manuals, there's all kinds of good, concrete advice about how to do that. For example, when a thought comes, do you simply follow it, and when you get to the end and realize what happened, come back? Or do you actually try to cut it off, cut it off, cut it off? Well, there are many different approaches. One of the great insights of Zen meditation, I think, is it has realized from the very beginning that the very effort to try to cut off thought is itself a thought. Right? The very effort to try to do that means you've already gone out into the thing. You've already turned it into something, and now you're trying to stop it. It's already gone. As they say, the arrow has already flown to Korea. It's gone. But it's also always right here. Even to say that much, just to return. So they simply say, no need to judge. You don't have to get angry. You don't have to hit yourself. Just return. Return once more patiently. Return once more patiently. Return. And they say, I used to think it was strange. It sounded so easy in the Zazen manuals. They'll say, as soon as you become aware that your mind has strayed, has wandered, simply return it. And after a while, the thoughts will no longer come up. I spent the longest time trying. I said, the thoughts are still coming up. It's not that simple. But With patience, over time, you start to realize that the thoughts themselves have no more need to arise. They have no more place to hold on to. And they just naturally dissipate. At first, they're there, but they don't last as long. And then after a while, you realize they're not arising. That's good, but you don't need to get hung up on that. That's good. But continue, trace back to the very source itself. And when you illuminate that, as I said, it's no longer you as a process. Yes, you realize it. But what happens when you actually fall in is it's no longer you doing it or it doing you. When you illuminate the source, that is the source of all illumination. That is the source of all illumination. And that's when the sparks really strike. That's when it's no longer a problem of you or something, some source. Of course, even to say the source, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. That source is you. That source is you. But until you've actually realized that, it's not you. But do you see, in a sense, how simple it is? You, in your present awareness, whatever awareness you have right now, smart, dumb, desirous, whatever, emotion, feeling, thought, sound, you have right now, comes from the source. And it can be traced back to the source. Some are better equipped to do that. some thoughts are better for that. In a sense, you can say that's what a koan is. A koan is made, is designed, so that you can't go out into the world and turn it into something. If you do, you realize that's not it very soon. You can't turn a genuine koan into something. That's what in the beginning is so frustrating about it, because you want to turn it into something, anything. You want to satisfy the teacher or yourself or something, such nonsense. But after a while, it's no longer something out there or in here. It's actually you yourself. And at some point, you actually stumble upon it. You, as I say, turn back and reveal the source. That's when it becomes clear. But you can't turn it into something. Well, I should say you can, but that's not really the koan. That's not really what a koan is, a Zen koan. If you've turned it into something, it's not a koan. It's not what's called the live word. At that point, it's the dead word. So do you see now, when I asked in the beginning, practice from where? From where do we practice? From where do we practice? Is it clear? To whatever extent you realize it, this is where the practice is from. There is nowhere to go. There is nowhere to go. This present awareness is where you practice from. Maybe it's full of selfish desire. Work with that. Maybe it's a very pure. Oh, fine, work with that. But your present awareness is all that you need. Your present awareness right now is all that you need. If you simply trace it to its source. To whatever extent you realize that, that's where we practice from. So you can get rid of the whole idea of trying to attain something. You can let go of that right now. You don't have to bring that up again. There is no place to get to. There is no place to get to. Even to say, to get to the source, well, where the hell do you think you are right now? To whatever extent you realize it. That's okay. We're not in a competition here. To whatever extent you now realize it, fine. Continue from there. Continue from there, not out into the world, not into the inner world either, into the source itself. You know, they often talk about for whom we practice. For whom, as I said in the beginning. Who are we doing this for? Who are we doing this for? Who are we doing this for? Why do we sit in Zazen? For who? For you? For me? Well, you know the official party line answer to that, right? The official answer is all beings, right? All beings. Isn't that strange? Can't we sit here and, you know, like, get it for ourselves first, and then maybe we can think about everybody else? Doesn't that make sense? Right? I mean, you got to do it yourself first, right? But Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism, begins with a ridiculous statement that we begin our practice from the standpoint of all beings. All beings. Why? Isn't that strange? But that's the only place we can practice. The present awareness, the source of present awareness,
is all beings.
It must be all beings. If it's still you,
you're not at the source.
And if it's for someone else,
you're not at the source either.
So they have this strange expression. Not the end. At the end, we do it for all beings after we've done it for ourselves. No.
Right?
If you know the Bodhisattva vows, right? The first vow, to make it even more absurd, states, beings are numberless, without number. Save them. That's the first vow, not the fourth, not the second or the third or the fourth. That's the first vow of all Mahayana Buddhists. Not only literally vowing to save all sentient beings, but jabbing you a little bit. They're numberless, endless. You can't put a limit on it. Isn't that absurd? How can you save all beings? Well, there is no other way. There is no other way. You can only save all beings at once. You can't save yourself. And you can't save another person. In Buddhism, salvation is saving all beings. That's the beginning and the middle and the end. That's why I use funny words like the source. That is the source. It must be all beings. The ones you love, the ones you hate. The ones you know about, and the ones you don't. If anything is missing, it's because you've turned it into something. Thought, emotion, feeling, doesn't matter. If anything is missing, it's because you've turned it into something that will not do. So it's not an exaggeration. It's the truth. Beings are numberless. Save them all. It's the only way. There is no other way. If you think you saved yourself, you're wrong. If you think you saved yourself, well, you're certainly not a Buddhist. If you think you can save yourself, you're deluded. If you think there's a self to save, you're deluded. And yet, beings are numberless. Vow to save, to really put it radically, every one of them. Every one of them. And that's true. That's what Buddhist salvation, is that a loaded word in Dutch? Sorry. It's a church. Well, Buddha, Buddhism, awakening. That's what it means. It's not your awakening. It's not mine either. It's the awakening of everything. Everything down to the last little particle of dust. That's where we practice from. That's not where we practice to. That's where we practice from. Right here. Right now. So you can right now put away the silly idea of trying to get somewhere or trying to save someone. That itself is just another delusion. All beings without exception must be saved. Of course, many of you know in the Diamond Sutra, it says that. And what does the next sentence say? Having saved all beings, there is no being to save.
What a strange, why did I say that?
Because it's true.
Because it's true.
There is no thing to be saved, and yet we endlessly, continually go on
with that practice.
There is no ego to be saved. It is an illusion. Remember how we started? And yet there are conditions of suffering, of dis-ease, right? And so we do everything we can, including what we're doing right now, to help them. And yet there are no beings to be saved. And the Diamond Sutra says, that is saving all beings. Damn right. And it goes on constantly. Coming from the source, going to the source. Well, just to show that I'm not making any of this up, let me end by quoting some official texts. Will that give me legitimacy? Okay. Will you believe me then? Huh? Do you want to get up and stretch for a minute? If anybody would like to get up and stretch, please feel comfortable. Go ahead. I'm saying the exact same thing, but this is from the first and most basic meditation manual that became the basis for Dogen's meditation manuals and much else. And this is how it begins. If you want the references and the Chinese titles and all that crap, I have it in the back, but we can talk about that later. If cultivation is not kept pure, cultivation, in other words, the practice, if cultivation, great Chinese metaphor, right? It's like you're out in the field, right? But it is. It's that kind of a labor, in a sense. If this constant practice, cultivation, is that, do you know the word? Cultivation. Cultivating the fields. If the practice, the cultivation is not kept pure, there is no way for any practice to yield realization. Again, if the cultivation is not kept pure, there is no way for any practice to yield realization. No matter what you do, you sit in zazen for hours and hours and hours. If it's not pure, of course, we need to look at what that means. Why do they use that word, pure? Well, to put it bluntly, from the source, but I'll quote here. Now it's trying to explain what that means. The basic essence of cultivation should be discerned, clearly seen. It is the inherently complete and pure mind, in which there is no false discrimination, and all is fundamentally pure, unborn, and undying. I call it the source. Okay? Once more. The basic essence of cultivation should be discerned, clearly seen. It is, in other words, that essence, that purity is, the inherently, it's already there, the inherently complete and pure mind. In other words, your present awareness. In which there is no false discrimination, and all is fundamentally pure. It's calling the purity pure. It's not very logical, I admit, but it's good. Unborn and undying. Unborn and undying. One more sentence. This mind, this present mind, this is the basic teacher. This is better than invoking the Buddhas of the 10 directions. That was a common practice back when this was written. This is the basic teacher, meaning your mind. You are the basic teacher. But it must be kept pure. It must be kept pure. That's why you practice with blood, sweat, and tears. But that's where you practice from. Okay? So no more chasing after things. It's clear. Okay. This is the beginning of the second most famous meditation manual. That was the first one. This is the second one. It's saying the same thing. The Bodhisattva awakened being. That's all of us. The Bodhisattva who studies prajna. That means wisdom. This wisdom. The Bodhisattva who studies prajna should first arouse the thought of great compassion. First. That's not the end. First arouse the thought of great compassion. Remember, this is a meditation manual. This isn't theory. In the next paragraph it says you put your right leg up, you put your left leg up, and you do the wu-si-ju-di-la. This is a meditation manual. This is not a sutra. Again, the Bodhisattva who studies prajna should first arouse the thought of great compassion, make the extensive vows, vow to save all beings, vow to study the way, and then carefully cultivate samadhi. Samadhi is calm. Calm. The discipline of calmness. Vowing to save all sentient beings, you should not seek liberation for yourself alone. Didn't I just say that a few minutes ago? I'll be damned. Hot dog. Once again, I'm quoting, vowing to save all sentient beings, you should not seek liberation for yourself alone. This is the beginning of the meditation manual, people, not the end. Again, then cast aside all involvements and discontinue all affairs. Then stop. Then stop. Make body and mind one with no division between action and rest. Then the practice is constant. Regulate food and drink so that you neither take too much nor too little. Adjust sleep so that you neither deprive nor indulge yourself. And then it goes on into how to sit zazen. Very practical. It sounded a little metaphysical there in the beginning, but you see where they're going? Then you give yourself up to the practice. But from where? From where? Let me talk about one more thing before I end, because it's on a lot of people's minds. Calm and clear, right? There are traditional technical Buddhist terms, if you want, that I can give you, but let's keep it simple. Calm and clear. What does that really mean in Zen? I think you already have a taste of it, but to make it clear. Calmness is not simply a state of mind. Calmness must finally be completely clear. If it's dead calmness, it's not what Buddhism is talking about. The calmness, and there are meditative techniques which focus on calming the mind. But again, that is not the end result. The end result is calming the mind so that you can clearly see. Dead calmness, cutting off all the emotions, all the thoughts, all the sights, all the sounds, is not what we're after. It must be the calmness clearly seen. It's not a matter of dead getting away from the activity, right? It must be calmness that can clearly see. And more importantly, for a lot of people here now, it must be clearly seeing. A common English word is insight in this term, right? Insight that must be ultimately calming. If it is not an insight that puts everything to rest, it's not Buddhism. But what is going on in a lot of Buddhist practice? And even a lot of people who don't even do Buddhist practice, they have insights. They are coming up and talking to me about it all the time. Sometimes on drugs, sometimes maybe it's a kind of a psychosis. I don't know, I'm not a psychologist. Sometimes it's falling in love. It can be all kinds of stuff. Sometimes it just comes from out of nowhere. They're not doing zazen or anything like that, but they sit down on the edge of their bed one day, look out the window, as one woman told me, and everything fell away. She was studying business. She wasn't studying religion or anything. Sat down on the bed she lived, she slept in all her life. One morning, yawned, looked out the window, and the sun was shining in, and she wasn't there anymore. And she spent 10 years struggling with that because she didn't know what to do with it. Had she gone crazy? She never felt better in her life, but how was she going to explain that she wasn't there anymore? So she struggled and she went through all kinds of hell because she didn't know what... Well, she had a very deep spiritual insight, completely spontaneous. Other people have it through sustained Zen or Buddhist practice. But look at what happens with many of those insights. The person has the insight, and instead of it becoming bringing, if it's a real Buddhist insight, you're seeing through so that everything is calm. But that's not what happens, is it? A lot of people have insights, and what result? Agitation. You can analyze and say, well, maybe because there's still some degree of ego left or whatever, that doesn't matter. What happens is they've seen through, but not seeing through all the way. I say see through to the source itself. If you've really done that, death itself is calm. Death itself is calm. Death is not outside of that. That's why Buddhism uses terms like unborn and undying. But look at what happens with many people who have insights. In the long run, they end up becoming agitated. You know that word? Sometimes they get even bigger egos about not having an ego. It's obvious. The clear seeing must lead to, I mean, it really comes from as well, that true calmness. It's not two different things. In a sense, you can say there are two approaches to arrive at, I'm sorry, for lack of a better word, I call the source. But the source is beyond being calm or being clear. It is the source of being calm and being clear. So be careful about experiences, having insights. In Buddhism, insight leads to true calmness. Be careful in your calmness that it doesn't become dead. That calmness just as clearly must be seeing through to the body. They really are two sides of the same coin. In the actual process you go through, it's not going to work out perfectly. You may find yourself getting more into one side or the other. Okay, just be aware not to fall into dead calmness or getting excited with insights, with experiences. Neither of them is Buddhism. Right? And then they disappear. That's the real thing, if I can call it that. But a lot of people are getting wrapped up in experiences and insights that are not genuinely Buddhist, because they don't lead to final falling away. So just as a word of warning about that, I myself have gone through and fallen into that one before, so I speak with some experience here. Well, I want to leave plenty of time for questions or comments. Let me just end with a quote from the Vimalakirti Sutra. It's about a great layman. And I couldn't help but think of Utrecht, Holland. I think he was talking about the place, although actually it didn't exist yet, did it? But anyway. The high plains do not produce lotus flowers. You know, the lotus flower, this is the symbol of Buddhism, in the midst of the filth and the dirt and the desire and that needs dirty water, right? This pure, perfect, unborn, undying, that's the symbol for Buddhism. The high plains do not produce lotus flowers. It is the mud of the low-lying marshlands.
You sound like Holland?
You used to be like that. It is the mud of the low-lying marshlands that produce them. What am I trying to say? Much of Holland is below sea level? No. Let me read it again. The high plains do not produce lotus flowers. It is the mud of the low-lying marshlands that produce them. This is the great layman saying. What is he trying to say? Is he talking about botany? Oh, Olaf, I better ask you. You got the PhD, right? Is he talking about... This is what you do for a living, right? Yeah, you can say that it is not by going beyond yourself into some kind of transcendent up the mountain. The only place that it can bloom is right here. Right here. Oh no, but I have too many delusions. Oh, okay. Now maybe when you get rid of